Hello, Ordinary Extraordinary Cemetery listeners. We just wanted to give you a heads up that some listeners may find today's episode a bit disturbing. We will be discussing the destruction of cemeteries and the recovery of bodies when natural disasters strike. While we do not go into detail about the condition of the bodies when they are found, we nevertheless know that this topic may make some listeners squeamish or uncomfortable. We hope you will continue to listen and learn, but we completely understand if you choose to skip today's episode. If you do continue to listen and want more information on today's topic, please be sure to visit our website, theordinaryextraordinarycemetery.com, for additional articles and a hotline number. And now, on to the episode. Welcome to the Ordinary Extraordinary Cemetery, where every death had a life and every life had a story. My name is Jenny.
And I'm Diane.
And today we are super excited to have on the show with us two very special guests. We have Ryan and Christine. And you guys want to tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves?
Sure. I'm Ryan. I guess if they listened to a few episodes ago, I was on, so I won't go through everything. But for the purposes of today's show, I am the chairman of the Louisiana Cemetery Response Task Force, which is an entity that is activated in disaster events to respond to specifically to damages to cemetery sites in the state. My background is a couple of degrees in anthropology, focusing on human remains, a few years as a contract archaeologist, and a couple of law degrees, and finishing out a PhD now on mostly cemetery matters. So with that, I'll turn it over to Christine.
Yeah, hi guys, I'm Christine. I work here at the Attorney General's office with Ryan, and I'm also a member of the Cemetery Response Task Force as well. So my job right now is the anthropologist on staff at the Attorney General's office. So I primarily deal with human remains and cemetery issues. My training and background is mostly in bioarchaeology and forensic anthropology. So I've dealt mostly with human remains from a variety of archaeological and current and historical contexts. I've done a couple of digs in different countries. So worked in Belize and Peru and the United States and Greece. So I've been lucky to be able to experience a lot of different scenarios in a lot of different places. But I've been here in Louisiana for about 6 years now. And so this is, you know, starting to get our disaster response is starting to get sort of, well, not usual. Nothing is exactly usual, but but we're experienced, that's for sure.
Well, we are super glad to have you both here. We're glad to have Ryan back. For our listeners who may just be tuning in and haven't listened to our previous episodes yet, Ryan did episode number 6 with us, which he talked about the research he had done in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and one of the cemeteries there, and how that all led to how the Old West is sort of perceived in that part of the country, and how law and order is sort of perceived in that part of the country, and what he discovered through his research at the cemetery there. So like you said, we won't give it away in this episode, but please, if you get a chance, go back and listen. It's super fascinating to listen to. Today, we're going to talk about what the task force recovery team does and what they've recently had to do and what they're probably still dealing with, I'm assuming, because it's probably a very long ongoing process. Now, one question that I do have for you, are there other task force like this in other parts of the country, or are you guys like the only one?
As far as we know, we're the first of our kind at the state level. The federal government has DMORT, which I can never remember what it stands for.
Disaster Mortuary Operations and something. Yeah.
Teams, maybe? So I don't know. Anyway, something. It's a disaster mortuary service that it's a federal entity that activates really for mass fatality events. Matter of fact, one of the guys that we work with now is a member of DMORT, and he was activated for the earthquake response in Haiti, for the remains recovery after the Shuttle Columbia disaster. And so in Louisiana, at least historically, during mass disasters, we've also had that federal assistance to deal with the impacts to cemeteries. And so after Hurricane Katrina and Rita in 2005, the impacts that occurred from the storm surge, the flooding, whatever, was managed at the federal level by DMORT. There really was no need for a correlative state level response team after that, or for that event. It was really after a few other disasters, and we don't know if it was because DMORT got tired of Louisiana, or which I don't think is fair. Realistically, I think that you know, that's not really their primary charge, is to deal with cemetery damage. And so since subsequent storm events, which is most of what our problems are, to Katrina and Rita, have caused cemetery damage, but not a massive loss of life. You know, they kind of have started turning to the states to just say, do whatever it is that you do or can do through your own structure. And so starting in 2012, when Hurricane Isaac hit Louisiana, we were left to our own devices. DMORT was not activated. We had four cemeteries south of New Orleans that were really hammered by the surge. And it was maybe a Category 1-2 at most when it came on shore south of New Orleans in 2012. But it just blasted out the burials, especially in, you know, these above ground burials, and not really the ones that you think of when you think of New Orleans, but just, you know, mausoleum structures and things like that. And that event scattered the remains of these people from these cemeteries all down the river, Mississippi River levee. And the levee was the only thing that kept them from really escaping into the river and then into the Gulf. And so the state was kind of left to cobble together a response team then on its own to say, how are we going to deal with this? And so it was a kind of a an ad hoc combination of Department of Health, the LSU, Louisiana State University's forensics lab and their students, contractors, and the Department of Justice here, just because we had an anthropologist at the time, this was Christine's predecessor, on staff. And so we helped them with that, but really didn't do a lot. You know, that was mostly managed by contractors and by LSU. So it really wasn't until 2016 when we didn't have a particularly bad hurricane event, but it was what's known around here as the Great Flood of 2016. And it caused massive damage across the central part of the state. And by the time the floodwaters started to recede, we realized there were impacts in 19 parishes, which is the equivalent of a county, to cemeteries. And what did we come up with? A total of 74 cemeteries impacted?
Yeah, 74. But just about 800 graves were impacted in that storm that we know of.
Right. And so, again, the disaster mortuary, the federal disaster mortuary service didn't activate. And so the state was kind of left to its own devices. And by that time, Christine was on staff here. And so we teamed up with two other people from our Department of Health and did a 74 cemetery wide response that included assessing the damages, recovering remains, analyzing remains to figure out who was who, organizing them to get them back into their appropriate grave spaces, and then working and supervising the contractors that were brought in to do the actual repair work to the cemeteries. And I will add, and I'll leave this one up to Christine, because this is her story, that during that event, in addition to having to do this kind of response work, Christine was flooded out of three different structures that she was living in.
Goodness.
So that was good times.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that 2016 was a great education in terms of disaster response and also in terms of dealing with insurance and with FEMA, the, you know, the funding that this process that we're still working on, you know, goes through. But yeah, my apartment flooded. Me and my poor dog had to get in a boat and get carted out of our our
oh, no.
spot, and then got picked up. And then my friend's house flooded out, and then we went to her brother's house, and then that one flooded. And so on, you know, 3 days later, where we're gonna go, and then, you know, realize that this is just gonna be a long haul effort. And in fact, we still have two cemeteries that we're wrapping up from the 2016 floods, and you know, they were not re-impacted by the three hurricanes that hit us
this year,
square on this summer. Well, so
2020, yeah.
Yeah, 2020. So yeah, that leads us kind of into 2020's issues, which of course is what we're dealing with primarily now, which is Hurricanes Laura and Delta, which took pretty much the same path. If people, you know, may not have heard about our double whammy, but we had about 6 weeks break in between the two of them, and then they took the same path, and then there was Hurricane Zeta that came along another month later. So
there were three. I knew there were two back to back, and then there was that third one. Okay. Yeah, we were talking about right before you guys got on. I was trying to remember the names of all of them that had hit you guys this last year, but it was a rough hurricane season down there for you guys.
Yeah, it's been good times. And, you know, so we're not even completely done with the 2016 response. But basically, just in terms of how we function and why we exist, was after that 2016 response that was cobbled together, the legislature said they kind of had enough of this ad hoc process. And so they formally created this Cemetery Response Task Force that we now are a part of. And so it includes the various agencies that you would expect to be activated, the State Cemetery Board, the Department of Health, Governor's Office of Homeland Security Emergency Preparedness, that's the name, the LSU's Forensics Lab, Department of Justice, where we work, and the State Coroners Association. So each one of those entities has a representative and the designee on the task force. But then as a practical matter, the functioning task force for dealing with human remains and cemetery problems is on the state's direct payroll. Well, it's us. and then we are assisted heavily by one contractor, with the Department of Health, who is a retired funeral director, which is a good thing, because, you know, we see the remains in the cemeteries from a very clinical perspective, having come up through the archaeology and bioarchaeological traditions, of dealing with human remains and doing forensic work and things like that. And so having a funeral director on staff with us, really, that does the human side of things, and can deal with grieving families who are dealing not only in a lot of cases with their homes that have been completely lost, but they also realize that their family members who they thought were, you know, nicely tucked away in a cemetery are now missing. So it's good to have that human touch and that human side to this, somebody that can handle that, because, grief is not my specialty. So we're happy to hand those kind of things over to him.
So I'm thinking, so you said like in the 2016 one, it was 74 cemeteries. And I'm assuming that's a combination of newer cemeteries as well as probably some very old ones that are in the mix in there. now that you guys have done this a few times, what is your initial response? Like, what do you do first to get started on this once these storms hit and you have to go in and start figuring out what's what and how to organize it all?
Well, and I'll say we start as soon as we see a storm coming, we tend to do a couple of things, and that one of them is to start data collecting and sort of figuring out where are the cemeteries, where could they possibly be, what might be in, you know, the splash zone, if you will, if we, you know, start to figure out a few, like, you know, components to whatever storm we're dealing with, whether it's tornadoes or floods or what have you. And so when we start that sort of process, we're looking for all the cemeteries, whether they're historic or currently being operated, whichever. We just are looking for all the data possible. And so we start really by running the roads and trying to take these assessments and really quick try to just go, is it impacted? Is it not? How bad is it? How many graves are we looking at? And then we tend to have to go back. So we have to do this, you know, a second time around because we just can't collect everything. This storm, we've been to 300 cemeteries thus far. And of that, like 200 or 150, somewhere in there, I guess we're still finalizing some of the numbers, have access. So we can't spend enough time at all of them and still get to all of them to have any sort of reasonable numbers for people when we have to say, okay, we need to start getting contact information for the cemeteries that have damage. So we try to do all that really as quickly as we can. But again, with three people, and lots of times those areas are just, they're still underwater. They're still, you know, so disaster prone that you can't get to them. You know, you have to be a little bit cautious of safety. And then we start to go into, you know, we think of these things in phases. So that's like phase one. Let's see what we can find and see what the status is. Then we have to go back and go into sort of the mapping and finding whether or not there's a cemetery authority, if they have maps. Usually they don't, and especially for those historic ones, you know, they often don't have anybody that has any maps of how the cemetery looked before the storm.
Right.
So we have to spend some time in the cemeteries, really getting to know the cemeteries and where things are and what's missing. You have to kind of try to do a grave by grave assessment of, okay, what do we expect here and what's missing? And yeah. So that's kind of in that phase one response.
And there's almost a regression analysis that we have to do, not in any statistical sense, but just in terms of just a you know, photographic sense of, you know, in this regard, things like Google Earth become pretty helpful, you know, because then we can go and pull recent aerial imagery that shows what that cemetery looked like before the event. And then compare it to our own data that we get on the ground to see what it was and now what it is. And, you know, we've been able this time, for the first time, to go out with drones and not just fly over the cemeteries to get an understanding and appreciation of what the impacts were right there, but then also to fly over the surrounding areas if caskets or burial vaults had been moved out of those cemeteries, to go and search for those beyond, you know, what we can walk to, fences and things like that. But yeah, that all of that kind of rolls into just trying to get our brains around the sense of the scope of the problem. And, you know, with Hurricane Laura, we dealt with a storm that was a hurricane across the entire length of the state, from its landfall in southwest Louisiana, Cameron Parish, which is where the brunt of the real bad cemetery impacts occurred, that really kind of separated people from their graves. And then as it moved north through the central part of the state, all the way to the Arkansas line, and admittedly, I don't know what happened beyond that, but we have been in cemeteries all the way to the Arkansas state line in Louisiana, and all of that is wind-related damage, where you'll see, you know, tombstones knocked over and shattered in some cases, trees falling on them, breaking them, either, you know, knocking over the markers and breaking them, or breaking open vaults that are exposed to the ground surface. And then with Delta really following that path right behind it, it just made it that much worse.
Right.
And Zeta was an odd one. It came in on the eastern side of the state and hit the New Orleans area. And if you can say that we got lucky, then that one was a lucky one, because in terms of cemeteries, it only impacted two to our knowledge.
Oh, wow.
One of them was an SCI-owned property, which is SCI, you know, it's a big multinational funeral cemetery corporation, and they were able to handle that one on their own. It was a historic site that saw the collapse of an entire facing on a wall vault in the city.
No.
But they're big enough that they were able to absorb that internally with insurance and equipment to just do repair work necessary. And the other one, you know, I don't know, some of your listeners might know this one, Holt Cemetery in New Orleans. It's a real famous pauper cemetery. One of the massive, I think it was a water oak, was uprooted and jammed into the ground. It hit about 20 graves, but the damage, oddly, was minimal. And, you know, because it's a municipal cemetery, the city was able to respond to that one. So thankfully, Zeta was not so awful from a cemetery perspective. But the other two surely made up for it.
Yes.
I think, just to kind of add to the numbers, I mean, I think you're right. We, at most recent count, were somewhere between 150 and 200 cemeteries impacted by the combination of those storms, with it's in excess of 2,600 graves across those that have some level of damage. And, you know, some of them are absolutely decimated. I mean, you go out and they had, 90% of the markers that were set and attached to the graves have been blown off by the storm surge. So even if you can recover them, then you still got to figure out who's who to get them back their graves. And then, in the worst situations, the contents were just removed by the force of the water coming through. And I think the folks that are down there helping us with the casket and remains recovery have found caskets as far away as 5 miles from their original burial. So we've had to in the process, I guess, of setting up a staging area at the coast. And so, you know, Cameron Parish is a coastal parish, a real small population. And in fact, they probably have more dead in the parish than living people. Just a realistic observation. And, so it's a remote area. It takes us from Baton Rouge, where we're based, about 3 hours each way to get there. And up until recently, there wasn't even any place to stay out there because of the devastation. So we were going back and forth every day. It's kind of, we're having to bring in everything that we need. We've set up a staging area for analysis of the remains that are recovered. Some of them have identities associated with the caskets. Some of them do not. And so, you know, we haven't even begun to do the analysis work, but we did set up our morgue tent down there a few weeks ago, and then it almost got blown away in a winter storm the other day. So, you know, I mean, we really are within about a mile as the crow flies from the Gulf Coast. So, you know, we really do deal with the heavy coastal winds down there, and I really don't like for things to stay put.
Apparently. Now, this is just my morbid curiosity question, but for the ones where you're finding a lot of the bodies in the caskets, were those mostly in above ground situations, like in the mausoleums or in the above ground graves? Or is it also because the floodwaters can be so high and strong that they're washing away the ones that are actually buried? Or do we know?
Not anything that is above ground or at ground. So our vaults, you know, are you think of the stereotypical fully above ground, but there are also a lot that are put sort of at ground level. So the lid theoretically is able to open and close. And that just depends on if the vault lid seal breaks. So we find that some of those have disturb the caskets. And then we do have some mausoleum structures down there that were impacted, have been impacted in every storm down there. So, and going back to, you know, Rita and Ike and,
that's really an interesting thing that we see when we're down there in these cemeteries doing our surveys is the memorials to the unknowns from prior storm events. We've seen it in multiple cemeteries. It'll just be a concrete slab with almost, I guess it's a cenotaph. Sometimes we think there are people buried there. Sometimes there aren't. And it'll just say, you know, to the unidentified dead who were lost in Hurricane Audrey in the 1960s, during Hurricane Rita in 2005, during Hurricane Ike in 2008. And that's another thing that we're finding too, is that a lot of the caskets that are recovered have been tagged by DMORT from being in response to Rita, in response to Ike in 2008. So some of these folks, this is their third attempt to make a run for it. It's a sad situation, and we're kind of boxed in with what we can do with them. A lot of the families are asking us, and that's the other aspect, is we're in constant contact with family members, and the family members are asking us, hey, we're tired of this. We don't want to go through this ever again. Can we just bury them underground? Because what we find is that if somebody's truly, truly buried underground here, they do stay put. There isn't enough scouring of the ground surface, even by the floodwaters, to, you know, pull up somebody that is 2 feet or more below ground surface. It's the ones that are exposed to the surface or that are on or above the surface that are the problems. And, you know, the response that we have to give these families is, look, we're here to do the organizational part, but the funding for all of this, whether it is, a cracked tombstone, a full reinterment, or what have you, is all coming from FEMA. And FEMA will not authorize payment to what they term as, quote unquote, improve the site. It has to be back exactly to what it was before the event. So if somebody was buried partially above ground, they're going back partially above ground with FEMA's funding and under their rules. And if that means that they will come up again, and boy, have we had these conversations with FEMA over the years, that guys, we're getting into a cycle. It's just not something that's contemplated by the rules. And so the families can opt to pay more to have them buried underground. But in a lot of cases, that just doesn't happen. So you see the ones that were, you know, up in Rita, up in Ike. And I think there was one in Hurricane Rita that was recovered that had gone missing in Hurricane Audrey in the 60s. So, you know, almost 30 years later, the casket was recovered in the swamps. So it is a recurring problem. And the current structure at the federal level for funding the repair work just doesn't allow for improvement.
Have they ever given a good reason for why they say it has to go? Like, to me, as far as a money saving thing, it would make more sense to do it differently so that they're not paying for this every time it hits a hurricane or a flood or whatever hits the same spot. If you know that's going to happen over and over again, why not fund it differently so you don't keep paying the same thing?
More of a preventative repair,
it doesn't make sense to me.
Well, you know, but it doesn't to us either. And we had that exact discussion with FEMA in 2016. It's one of those big government, I think, problems of one side not communicating with the other, because FEMA has a mitigation group that says, put these people underground. We don't want them coming up again. It's costing more money. And then we have the side, which is the funding side, that says paying for what it was before, and they're not meshing, so every time we're putting them back as before. So we try to tag everything so that if and when it comes up again, you know, we'll have better information on who it is and where it is.
My hearts go out to those families that keep having to deal with this over and over and over again, and you know, it's hard enough to bury somebody the very first time you have to do it, but then to think about doing it three or four or five times, because you live in a location where storms are an issue, that's just, so yeah, my heart goes out to those families that are dealing with it over and over again.
Yeah, it is. It's a sad situation for them, and we feel for them. And you know, some of them have opted to move their loved ones further inland. And the odd thing is that occasionally FEMA will assist in that funding. But not all of them want to move. You know, they have this community where they are, and they want to stay there. And you know, we get that. And of course, we're beholden not just unto FEMA's funding rules, but unto the families' desires as well. We really say, look, the task force is here to facilitate. We know that you guys are trying to, you know, patch your homes back together, your lives back together. But let us deal with this thing that's just terribly unfamiliar to everybody. You know, so it's a very strange situation. And the other part of it really is managing the expectations of the families. Because, you know, if you watch CSI or something like that, you see that, hey, you know, we can take a DNA sample and know who this is in 5 minutes and get them right back with their.
Not the reality that we're dealing with.
There's another podcast they listen. It's a true crime podcast, and they laugh about it all the time. They call it the CSI effect, because people watch those shows and they totally expect that science is going to fix it in 45 minutes, and it doesn't actually work that way.
Yeah.
We would like it to.
Yeah. Then to like getting everything organized and done. And again, this is where, you know, we love being able to be involved and help everybody through the process and doing this work, but it is hard to feel like, gosh, I wish we could move faster. I do, you know, if TV shows were, that it would be, you know, in a week, it'd all be fixed. And that would be great. I would fix this in a week. But our reality is, you know, we're just getting, as Ryan said, to setting up a staging area, because we've been, you know, it takes a while to get everything set up and transported and, you know, figuring out, okay, what's going to be the best place that we can do this long term. And, you know, once we're through those initial stages, then we've got still months of coordinating with contractors and getting their schedules freed up. They're still busy. They have the contractors who do this work in terms of who are going to assist in getting headstones reset. You know, they have heavy equipment. Well, they're also working funerals. So they're really busy right now anyways. How do we mesh schedules like that to get things done and get the funding? And so, you know, there's a money component with FEMA. There's a contractor component. There's a finding all the people and know where they go piece to it. And that takes a long time, like, you know, 4 years for 2016 and counting. So,
well, and don't forget about COVID.
You know, that was part of the reason we couldn't stay anywhere closer to Cameron Parish, is that, you know, in the disaster response world, you had to think about how are you going to shelter all the people who need shelter, who got impacted, who are, and, you know, not spread COVID around. And so how do you do that? You take up the hotel, you take up anywhere you can that's not congregant, you know, so that you know, you're spreading people around a bit, you know, but that doesn't make disaster response workers, you know, anymore. Doesn't give us any more access than anybody else. So, you know, for better or for worse, it's everything just moves at as fast as we can, but that's of course going to be limited by so many factors.
Yeah. And I think, you know, too, the families, again, with the CSI effect, really think, you know, we'll go take a DNA sample and identify their loved ones. And, you know, even, well, first of all, FEMA does not fund DNA testing for the previously deceased. But even if they did, the realistic scenario that we're faced with is it isn't TV. And, you know, those IDs just don't work very well. You know, we did a recovery not related to a storm in 2015 of somebody that had been dead and buried in South Louisiana for 15 years, and trying to verify his identity with DNA was virtually impossible. The remains had just degraded too much. The condition of the DNA had degraded too much, and stuff just wasn't even recoverable. So we're left to do standard anthropological analyses of these remains to try to figure out who these people are, if we're unlucky enough to find a casket that doesn't have their identity in it. And those are just spectacular red letter day findings. You open a casket and it's got some identifying information. It's got a name. And I mean, we jump up and down. Oh my God, we've got one. because that means we've definitively got somebody and it's an easy one. And then we can call that family and say, we got them. Which is a good thing, because then, you know, because the families know that their family members have been disrupted. I mean, they go out and see the cemeteries, and they are upset,
right?
Not upset with us, but just upset with circumstances. But to be able to call them and say, you know, we've got your mother, we've got your grandfather, your son. I mean, that's an awesome thing, and they're so happy, and we're happy for them. But you know, the unfortunate reality is that there's still going to be a handful that just can never be identified again. And even if we recover them, they still may not be identifiable. And that's a sad thing. It's a hard pill for the families to swallow. You know, and for that, our hearts just go out to them.
Right. Yeah. As far as like the historical aspect, I don't know how many of the bodies you've found that might be older than a more recent burial with, you know, within the last, say, before 60 years or more out, then those remains I would think might be even tougher to identify, just because, I mean, there's a chance families aren't even in the area anymore. They've moved on, they've done their things. In those cases, what do you end up doing with those unidentified remains? Where did those go? Or do they go back to a similar cemetery? Or do you guys do something different?
Well, and some of this will be a little case by case, but generally speaking, if we got, using 2016 as an example, there were in one cemetery 15 persons that could never be positively identified. So working with that cemetery authority, the church that ran that cemetery, we came together with the contractor, created a plan so that we could bury them each still individually. We decided to go individual rather than, a larger group area, mausoleum or anything underground, so that they could be accessed should we be able to positively identify them in the future. We wanted them to still have their unique person available and obtainable. So we buried each one of them individually. And, you know, if we get positive identifications, we'll be able to move them into an identified spot with a headstone later on. So I imagine that if going forward from these storms, we'll do something similar if we can and keep them as individual as possible, but as secure as possible, so that they're not going to go anywhere in the meantime, but we would have access to them should we get a positive ID. But that will probably be in each cemetery, because I think this one, with in terms of the scope and everything, it's going to have to be every cemetery that we can identify. And then we're going to have some serious discussions about what to do if we don't know where they came from and we don't know who they are. So that will probably be an ongoing discussion.
Yeah. But I mean, the major point, I guess, is to try to make the unidentifieds as recoverable as possible. And, you know, so we have unique case numbers assigned to each of them. And from the 2016s, event, that those unidentified, their current granite grave markers, it says unidentified, but then has their case number engraved on the tombstone. We're a public entity, so we have obligations to preserve all of our records indefinitely, at least these records. And so, you know, if 100 years from now, somebody decides that they know who somebody is based on all kinds of different factors, they can find our file, they can find that grave, and either put a formal commemoration for that individual on the tombstone, or you know, have them moved or what have you. So yeah, kind of reversibility for the unknowns is a key factor, because they could be identified later.
Have you run into any situations with especially with the hurricanes and how devastating they can be, and they take out the buildings and they take out everything? Have they taken away record storage where you might be able to more easily access, you know, information on particular cemeteries, but now it's wiped out? So now you don't even have that access anymore. Has that occurred?
On these events, I'm not as sure. The more recent ones, I know after Hurricane Katrina, the Louisiana Cemetery Board, which is the state regulatory entity for operating cemeteries, their entire facility in the New Orleans area was hit by floodwaters. And I don't think it was actually floodwaters. There were a few floors up. I think it was actually shattered windows and water coming in from wind damage and rain that destroyed a lot of their records. They had to go through a reclamation process and still lost things. And again, you know, with SCI being that big multinational, they have some of those famous cemeteries in New Orleans, like Metairie Lake Lawn, the one that folks, you know, probably would recognize in most imagery from the city. And they had floodwaters bad, and they had to go through a process where their records were frozen to preserve them, and recovered through some kind of archival document recovery process from that frozen state. It was I don't know that we've seen that as much now. The real problem that we run into, especially with these historic cemeteries, is they never kept records to begin with.
Or they didn't come back after the entity that ran them didn't come back after, you know, Rita or something. And so we've got where the church used to be, and we don't even know really where that congregation necessarily went and any records that went with them. You know, we're, again, since, you know, neither of us were, you know, part of anything that was happening after Rita, we don't really know those details. And so some of that is, it's still under investigation, but I'm guessing that we, you know, if they've got records, they could be long gone from various storms, maybe not this one, but maybe something prior.
So from your standpoint, you're a small group, obviously. There's three of you doing most of the work and trying to do all of this, everything that goes along with it. Is there something that people in the public can do to help you guys to make things easier? Or who do they contact if they happen to come across, you know, one of those cemeteries that maybe you just haven't had a chance to get to? What can the general public do to help you guys try and make this a little easier for everybody?
Or even families for, you know, recent burials, what could they do, or information they could place in the coffin or whatever, that, God forbid this happens again, that would make your job easier?
Yeah, I mean, those are excellent questions. You know, I think, here we are talking about this situation happening in Louisiana, and it seems a bit redundant because it happens, you know, every so often in Louisiana. But the reality is that this problem happens, or at least could happen, in any coastal area with the flooding. And of course, there are natural disasters, even out where you guys are in the mountainous west, that could impact cemeteries. So we've got a lot of experience with it, but it doesn't mean it's not applicable elsewhere. So I think the question of, you know, what can be done is, you know, most caskets today have some sort of identifying information that can be placed with them. Batesville caskets have what they call memory tubes, where it's a little piece of paper that's filled out, put in what's supposed to be a watertight tube, and is screwed into the casket. You don't even have to open the casket to get it. And those have been helpful when they've been done. But a lot of funeral homes we've seen just haven't even gone to the trouble of filling out those little forms. But then the stuff that, you know, unique items that are in those caskets that people put with their loved ones, those are also extremely helpful.
My favorites are what, the six pack of beer and tobacco or something. I mean, anything like that is really, it's truly uniquely identifying.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, we were able to identify folks in 2016 based on photographs that had been placed in the caskets with the loved ones. A lot of folks would have embroidered blankets with their name on them. And so you would open the casket and immediately see what, their name. But with the families, it's really, you know, remembering the clothing, remembering what they were buried in, what they were buried with. I think to answer the question of what do you do when you see these, when you find these, or if you find a cemetery like this. So to those of your listeners who happen to be in Louisiana, we actually have a hotline now, and a dedicated email address. And, you know, if they get a report of this, we'll go out and investigate it. Or, you know, if they send in a report of it, we'll go out and investigate it, see if it's part of the storms, and then try to deal with it. You know, I think to folks in other states, the best I know to say is, you know, if you guys are unfortunate enough to have this stuff happen, it's probably going to be left at the local law enforcement, coroner, medical examiner level to deal with these things. And, you know, in a lot of cases, those folks aren't in that business. You know, the medical examiners are in the business of identifying causes of death, not going to find somebody who's been blown out and has been dead, you know, 10 years.
Well, incredibly, I think, you know, we rely a lot on now these online databases that are from, you know, just people who are happy to go and record data, you know, in cemeteries, names and stuff. And what we really, really appreciate is when we've got pictures of cemeteries, kind of wide shots, and so that you can see where things were and whose headstone might be where. You know, you get a lot of really close-up pictures, which is nice for the family, but for our purposes, when we're looking at these things, you know, later on, it's sort of like, oh God, I wish they had just got a little bit wider, you know. Or you know, if and some of these genealogy websites or something that detail all the people, that's great, we got names and that, and births and years and dates of death and stuff, and that's all really useful. I think if we would always encourage people, if they're interested, to you know, even if they made a rough map and uploaded it to one of those sites that's really commonly used, you know, or if you have a state cemetery board and you just, you know, we're willing to go out and map a cemetery, a small one, or even take a GPS coordinate for here's where one is, you know, and then get that to whoever, whatever agency you can get it to in the state. So, you know, and again, for us, that would be the Louisiana Cemetery Board. And I know that there are other.
Well, yeah, just so there's some record of it.
Some record somewhere, you know, that makes it a lot easier for us to function.
Even those small family cemeteries, you know, mm-hmm. keeping track of where those are because they get hit too. But I mean, you know, absolutely a shout out to the folks that upload stuff to mm-hmm. Find a Grave, that upload genealogical data to various sources. You know, one of the folks that we've worked with here just started his own site, LA Cemeteries. And I encourage everybody to take a look at it. It's cool. It's mm-hmm. got a lot of data. And it just allows you to get down and granular to these sites that, you know, and the sources that he's pulled from are, you know, maps and Find a Grave and various other stuff. And I don't know that these things exist in every state, but certainly, you know, we just rely greatly on, well, the generosity of strangers. Mm-hmm. I mean, we really need that community input in terms of where these resources are, because if that's not out there, then we don't even know where to begin looking to find that damage. And the unfortunate reality is that FEMA's got a window during which it'll allow folks to register to get these things repaired, and during which it'll pay out for repairs. So, you know, if somebody today finds a cemetery was damaged in 2016, it's too late. And the cost of those repairs are on them, you know, as family members, and not, and you know, we can't tap the disaster resources. So, you know, the sooner folks can find them and report the damages, the better. And that allows us to funnel it through existing funding sources.
That's what I was going to ask you. Like you mentioned, some of the bigger cemeteries that are either SCI owned or city owned. What about the smaller family owned cemeteries, or like you said, church cemeteries? They have to file. There's help from FEMA, but only within a certain amount of time. And if not, it's like, say, a plantation cemetery or something, if the owner doesn't know or whatever, then it's, there is no funding.
Yeah, if they don't know, there just is no funding, because the windows for reimbursement from FEMA will pass. But for those smaller cemeteries, the private ones, the historic, family, fraternal, that kind of stuff, those are funded through FEMA's individual assistance program, which is the same program that funds your house repairs after a disaster. And they don't care if you have insurance or not, which is usually a threshold for whether you'll get funding for your house. If you've got insurance, they say, exhaust your insurance and come talk to us. But for cemeteries, they say, we don't care what your insurance situation is. Do you have damage in a cemetery? Yes. Then show us proof and, you know, we will fund, usually up to a certain limit, we will fund the repair work out there. And so that's really what we're doing with the task force in the phase that we're in now, is working with contractors to figure out what those expenses are, and then working with the families to make sure they're registered with FEMA so that we can funnel that money from them to the contractors, and the contractors will go out and do the work. But yeah, I mean, there is funding available. The registration period is usually, what, 60 days following the disaster. So it requires folks to really get out and get a sense of what's out there, which is why we do that running of the roads to try to find the damage ahead of things and get the word out to families ahead of time so that we can get ahead of that deadline. Now, the repair work, you know, that can go on for a long time, and FEMA will pay out for up to about 18 months.
Yeah, a year and a half, and which seems like a long time, but and we'll be through that in no time. Yeah.
Well, especially if you're dealing with 200 cemeteries, you know, in that short amount of time.
It is a lot of work, but it's rewarding and it's interesting.
Thank you again to Ryan and Christine for joining us today. We are so grateful that you could bring your knowledge to the show and really kind of help inform our listeners of what happens when natural disasters strike and how that has to be handled. We hope that this inspires other states to maybe form their own task force if this is something they have to deal with on a regular basis. As I said before the podcast today, if you are interested in more information on today's topic, we have articles on our website, as well as the hotline number that Ryan mentioned. The website is theordinaryextraordinarycemetery.com, and you will find those articles as well as that hotline number in the show notes for today's episode, and that is episode number 15. You can also visit us on social media. You will find us on Instagram and Facebook at Ordinary Extraordinary Cemetery, and you can find us on Twitter at OrdExtraSim. You can also email us any questions you might have or any suggestions for future episodes. Our email address is ordinaryextraordinarycemetery@gmail.com. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Until we meet again.